the music. Cut the music.
I think I got my swagger back.
Spectacular group of men. You go find them, you throw your arms around them, you give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
Oh, the band is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Like poison. Like rat poison.
Are you going to listen to me or are you going to listen to these guys?
And welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. My name is Josh Parcell, the host of College Football Country, CFBCountry.com. You guys know the drill by now. Check out the website. I'm writing every day. Maybe every day. I like to think it's every day. Sometimes it's every other day. But I'm trying to keep you guys up to date, up to speed on all the latest in college football, the voice of college football fans everywhere, and of course the podcast which you're listening to right now. If it's your first time listening, thank you. Welcome for joining. Make sure you guys subscribe on iTunes, subscribe on Stitcher. Wherever you listen to those podcasts, it should be available. If it's not, let me know. I'll get it up there as soon as I can. Today I've got two great guests, Luke Del Rio, former Florida quarterback and emerging college football media star. He's going to join me first before I welcome on Dane Brugler of The Athletic. Now, Dane is an NFL scout analyst, does the NFL draft for The Athletic, does an awesome job, has been covering it for years. We get into, at the beginning of the interview, just his story of how he got involved with scouting. Really cool story, great story of how to hustle, how to make it and start from scratch and work your way up with networking and just gritting and grinding. You know, hashtag grind. That's what Dane Brugler does, and he does an awesome job. If you don't subscribe to The Athletic, you need to. They do such a great job. A lot of great content for sports fans. Cuts through the BS, and they just do such an awesome job. Dane has only been there for about a month, but already I read everything that he's posting. Every week he's got something new covering the NFL draft. So I'll talk to him about plenty, not specifically to the draft necessarily, but just getting his take on a new point of view, a different point of view on maybe Alabama versus Georgia, on some of the best quarterbacks in college football, about the style of offense that you're seeing every week. He's got a great perspective on that. I'll talk to him plenty about that later on in the show. Don't forget, go review the podcast. I need about 50 more reviews. I think I'm actually about 48 shy to be exact right now. When we hit that 150 mark, I will reward one listener with a $25 Amazon gift card for whoever has the best name. I need the most creative, most random, most amazing college football player you can think of. I need the best name as the reviewer. How cool would it be? I just want to get to 150. Imagine when we get to 1,000. Let's get all the reviews we can. I want the best names. I want somebody to pick up College Football Country, to go look at it on iTunes, and I want them to see, holy cow, Rodrigo Blankenship listens to the College Football Country podcast? I never knew that Kenyon Rambo was a fan of the College Football Country podcast. I never knew that Alonzo Tweedy listened to the College Football Country podcast. I want people to think that the best and greatest, most amazing players listened to the College Football Country podcast. That's my dream. That's all I want. Can you guys help me out? Thank you so much. If you can, leave a 5-star review, leave a rating, whatever you got to do, just do it. Go do it right now. Pause the podcast. Come back. It's not going anywhere. We've got Luke and Dane coming up next. It'll be right here. Okay, now that you did that, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's get on to the podcast. We'll have Kyle Bailey coming up tomorrow to talk anything and everything ACC, so make sure you guys tune in for that as well. And then Friday, we'll go take the points once again. We're buying the boat. Hashtag buy the boat. Last 2 weeks haven't gone so well. The boat might need to be rescued, but we'll get there. Don't worry. Thanks again, guys. And now, Luke Del Rio. And now, welcome on former Florida, former Alabama, Oregon State quarterback, current aspiring media member who's already crushing the game. Luke, I wish we had been recording before we even started the podcast, because we just had about a 30-minute conversation on kind of how you're getting started and where you want to be. And I got to say, that might be better than the next 30 minutes we're about to have. So next time I'm just going to press record the second we catch on the phone, and then maybe we'll put together a good podcast that way.
I know. We should probably do that. And thank you for having me on, Josh. But if everybody heard the first 30 minutes, they might be disappointed with the rest. So at least they'll be happy with what I'm about to give them.
We'll try to pick up the slack here. So real quick, Luke, before we get started, I could read your Twitter bio, or I could just ask you to tell the listeners where they can find you, because you got a good thing going on with your Periscope show. Kind of tell everybody what you're up to right now and where they can listen to you talk college football.
Yeah, so I have a show that I do 4 days a week. It's called The Drop Back. It's Monday, Wednesday, Friday evenings, and then a Sunday college football recap at noon. All times are East Coast times. And I talk about Gators every week because I did go to Florida, and obviously I played at Florida. But I talk all college football and all NFL bets, predictions, and I give you insight because I grew up in an NFL family. My dad was an NFL head coach for 9 years with the Jacksonville Jaguars, and then the past 3 years with the Oakland Raiders before John Gruden got there. So I have a lot of unique insight that I don't think a lot of media members have, and I incorporate that into my show every day.
Yeah, and you've been doing this show for a while, but it wasn't until, I guess, a few weeks ago, you kind of made some headlines there, Luke, when you told the story about Jim McElwain and some of the players that were on scholarship losing their scholarships and the way they found out about it. So I'll let you kind of recap that story in a nutshell. What was kind of the story that kind of launched you into the forefront of a lot of people's minds nationally here with that Periscope show?
Yeah, so it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I told everybody that I had this Coach McElwain story that they didn't want to miss. And the reason why I decided to tell it is because I was shocked that it hadn't come out in the mainstream media. So I felt obliged to tell it myself. I walked on at Alabama. I walked on at Florida. I earned a scholarship at Florida. And Coach Mack is the one who put me on scholarship at Florida. But I found out that something was going on while I was there. And what was going on was walk-ons that earned scholarships under Coach Mack, he never released them in front of the whole team. He never said, you know, like those surprise videos that we all see towards the end of training camp, whether it's on the Jumbotron or in a team meeting and the guy gets swarmed. We never did that. And I was kind of wondering why my first and second years at Florida, and then I finally caught on to it. Over the 3 years that I was at Florida, these guys that were being put on scholarship, these walk-ons, always had eligibility left. So, you know, the guys that were seniors, they were on scholarship for that 1 year and then they left, and that was great. But the majority of them had 2 or 3 years left, right? And I found out that he was pulling the scholarships from the walk-ons who had earned them and not telling them in person. The way that the walk-ons, now scholarship, now walk-on again, players were finding out was they would get their scholarship check or the kind of renewal in the mail, and it looked the exact same as everybody else's, except all of the dollar figures were zeros, and that was how they found out. There was no phone call, there was no meeting, there was no, you know, explanation as to why that happened. The parents weren't notified. I mean, you're talking about, you know, I don't know how much it is for out of state, but it's dozens of thousands of dollars to go to the University of Florida. And you go from, I know a lot of these guys were taking out student loans, and the relief that that family must feel when you're on scholarship, and then to have that ripped away. It was so bad the way he went about it. It was cowardly. I owe Mac a lot because he gave me a chance when not a lot of people would have, but I cannot defend him on that. It was really just wrong. Wrong is the right term.
So I watched the video, and I mean, you pulled no punches. You were very honest about the whole thing. I had a couple of takeaways from that. One, did you have a bigger issue? Well, I know what you had a bigger issue with, but was it mostly the way he handled pulling these scholarships? I mean, let's say he did pull these players into a meeting, an individual meeting, and tell them to their face, hey, I know we put you on scholarship for X amount of time, but we're going to have to pull that to make way for this five-star kid that we're going to give a scholarship to in this next recruiting class. If he had done it that way, would you have been okay with the whole situation, or do you still think that once a guy's put on scholarship, you should probably honor that for the rest of their career?
Right. Well, first of all, I should clarify, I forgot to mention that the reason why these scholarships were being pulled is because he said that he needed them to recruit.
Right.
Which is a joke, because when you put walk-ons on scholarship, they are now players on your team, aka you do not have that spot for a recruit. It's not like, oh, you get it for now until we really need it. Mm-hmm. So back to your question, was it the fact that he did it, or was it the way that he did it that really ticked me off so much? I would say it's 50-50, because I've never seen that happen. I went to three colleges. I was at the best university, still is the best university for football right now, Alabama. I was at a Pac-12 school, the worst Pac-12 school, but a Pac-12 school, Oregon State. And then I was at a really respected and historic program like Florida. I had never seen that happen, ever, where walk-ons had their scholarship pulled for any reason. If walk-ons are on scholarship and then they get arrested or they have failing grades, they just kick them off the team.
Right.
Like, that's how they handle walk-ons. Like, it is a privilege for you to be on this team. We do not need you at all. If you're going to be a problem, you can get off the team. And I saw that plenty, right? This was not that. They never got in any legal trouble, none of them.
Yeah.
The grades were never a problem. So just the fact that they got taken away at all pissed me off the most, I would say. And then the way he did it was just the cherry on top. And it kind of goes back to, what kind of person are you? You know, do you want to tell tough, bad news to somebody's face, or you just right. kind of want to sweep it under the rug? And I think the way you do little things is the way you do everything. And I actually learned that from Coach Saban. And the more years of life experience that I have, the more that reigns true. So I just, his kind of standing in my eyes decreased significantly when I found out that was going on.
Well, and I mean, it's clearly, it can be a reflection of your character as a coach, and at its core, college athletics is supposed to be about developing young men and being a role model for 18 to 22 year old kids. And when you treat somebody that way, I wouldn't call that being a role model. Now, you've been in three programs. We know that, we've established that. You've seen this much more up close and personal than I have. I've been around plenty of college programs, not to the level you have. I'll take you at your word when you say this doesn't happen at other places. I would play the devil's advocate role in a sense. We can both agree, first and foremost, the way he went about this was wrong. The idea right. that you put a walk-on on scholarship. Scholarships are not four-year contracts. They're renewable every 6 months or every year, whatever it may be. If you want to put a walk-on on scholarship for a year and you're doing it maybe because you have an extra scholarship for transfers or you didn't sign a full class, whatever that might be, and you want to give the kid a bone and give him a scholarship, I could kind of understand, if you handle it appropriately, saying, hey, we gave you the scholarship for a year, we're going to make room now for another player. I could see both sides of that fence, because I could see you as a program, if you kind of gave this kind of bone to a walk-on player for a year, do you really want that to hamstring you when you might have the opportunity to go sign a five-star wide receiver and you don't have that open scholarship unless you make that move? I could see both sides of it, because as a walk-on, you could be appreciative that you got something at all. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like you're pretty much, once you get the scholarship, that should be the way you should have that for the rest of your career.
Right. So a couple of things. When you are put on scholarship, it's kind of an unwritten rule. Yes, they are year to year.
Right.
It's a very new thing, these four-year scholarships. It's very new. They are year to year, but you are on scholarship. That's unwritten. You're on scholarship.
Yeah.
You will be on scholarship until you have either left for the NFL, graduated, have no more eligibility, or get kicked off. There is no, you'll be on it, we'll see how you play. No, you're
yeah.
putting me on scholarship. That's a commitment. I came here, and your commitment to me was giving me a scholarship. So it's not in writing that it's a four-year scholarship. But again, I've never seen guys have it taken away. Now,
yeah.
the exception is, it is very common for special teams players, because, look, how many plays do they play in a game? If you're punting a lot, 8 to 10 times, I mean, that's punting almost every drive, you know? Field goal kicker, if you're scoring a ton, you're on the field for what, 20 plays max? My first game, I played 80-something plays. So it's not even close.
Right.
So it is common for special teams players to split scholarships. So if I'm the kicker and you're the punter, I get the scholarship in the fall, so I do not have to pay tuition for books, all of that. And then the spring, I have to pay for everything, but now you're on scholarship. So that is common. You know, baseball has the
yeah.
percentage scholarships. that's kind of how football deals with players that don't necessarily play a large percentage of plays.
Yeah, that makes sense, and that's fair. Like I said, I see a little bit of both sides. This is something that's prevalent in college football. I mean, if you give a guy a scholarship, he's going to be on scholarship for the rest of his career. It kind of starts to gray the line or blur the line between are they student athletes or are they employees? Because it seems to me like Mac's treating them almost like employees. And if you start to pull these scholarships for essentially performance, you're basically treating them like an employee, right? I mean, that's where we start to blur these lines, and these players aren't getting probably as much as they truly deserve. I mean, how do you stand on that? I know that's a rabbit hole we could go down forever, and I don't want to spend the whole podcast doing that. But, I mean, do you feel like the athletes, given what can happen at Florida, what did happen at Florida, do you think the athletes are being supported enough? I mean, as somebody who went through it, do you think they deserve more financial compensation than what they're already getting?
You know, it's tricky because I do think that we are amateurs, but the amount of hours that we put into it and the amount of revenue that we make the school,
exactly.
You know, it's hard to say this for every sport, because for almost every single school, football pays for all the other sports programs.
Right.
Kentucky men's basketball is one of the few basketball programs that pays for itself. They make enough money to pay for their own program, and they're at the top, right? Every other school, football, with the amount of equipment or jersey sales and tickets and all of that, they make enough revenue to basically fund the rest of the pile. So the one loophole that I see, kind of an avenue for players to get paid, is they should be able to get paid for their likeness.
Yes.
I've seen way too many pieces of merchandise, like Alvin Kamara, when he was at Tennessee, they were selling shirts and it had a Tennessee helmet that you were kind of looking into, and all you could see was a nose ring and gold teeth. And everybody knew that's Alvin Kamara.
Right. Yeah.
So he didn't make a cent off of that. And then jersey sales, you should get that too. Nobody's going to buy your jersey unless you're a good player. That does not affect the overall budget. That does not affect other schools. I'm just saying, if you cut out jersey sales, not many people buy jerseys anymore, I don't think. Not like they used to. But if Tim Tebow or Johnny Manziel or Cam Newton got their jersey sales, wow, they would have made a lot of money in college. I mean, I'm sure Cam and Johnny, I doubt Tim just because he's a saint to everybody in Florida. I'm sure they made money some way else. But, you know, I don't see how that is against any kind of, you know, code of ethics or would undermine the university, because they're basically making money off of your performance alone.
Do you think that if players were allowed to do that, I mean, this is only going to affect a small percentage of football players, let alone all of student athletes in general, but if you allow that to happen and the more prominent players, starters, of course, star players, they're starting to make a little bit of money, do you think that that would at all curtail what's going on underground? I mean, the money that's being changed hands between boosters and players, recruits, things like that. Do you think that would deter kids from trying to take the money illegally? Or do you think that that's just going to be basically icing on top of what they're already getting if the NCAA opens that up and legalizes making money off your likeness?
Well, it's definitely not going to cause a problem that isn't already there. I mean, the amount of kind of underground deals that go on just in recruiting alone. I mean, guys that never step foot or play it down for certain teams, they get paid thousands. They get promises, you know, no drug test promises. We'll put you in a house, we'll buy you a car. And it's not necessarily the school saying this. It's almost always boosters.
Right.
That can kind of go behind the curtain and say, hey, you need to know about this, but would you like a Tahoe, a brand new 2019 Tahoe? I'll make it whatever color you want. You know, like if I'm a struggling 17, 18 year old and I come from a bad area, how do you not accept that? You know,
yeah.
So I don't think this whole, my idea of paying them for likeness, look, if you end up being a good player and you earn that, good for you. It's not really going to change anything else though, in my opinion.
Yeah. I guess it gets on a slippery slope, because if you say likeness, what's to say a booster giving a backup quarterback, it doesn't matter, giving a football player a car technically you're capitalizing on your likeness, right? I mean, you're capitalizing on your ability. You're capitalizing on your talent. They're not giving a car to the best med school student. They're giving a car to a football player because of what he represents and what he does for the school, what he does for the football team. So I think when you start to say likeness, I think you have to really – it would be tough to define that. And where does it start and where does it end? It's interesting because, I mean, to hear you say that.
I think it'd be easy, though. I think it'd be easy because you could just say, hey, you're going to get all or a big portion of the profits from school-run sites and stores mm-hmm. of, you know, products that have either your name, your face, your number on them. And then other than that, you do not get a piece of that. But from mm-hmm. what we sell as a school, you get that because you've made us so much money.
Interesting. See, I that certainly makes sense. What do you think then? Because in that scenario, the money now is going out of the school's pocket. Now, like you said, they're not going to be hurting, but the money would go out of the school's pocket because right now they're taking all of that revenue, that all of those profits, and now you're splitting those profits between the players. What would you say if you, Luke, who just played at Florida, if a local car dealership or a local restaurant or whatever wanted to do a commercial with you or some sort of advertisement with you, and they wanted to pay you $500 or $1,000 or whatever, that's no money out of the school's pocket, but you're still being able to capitalize on your likeness locally. It's not a huge deal, but it's money for you. Is that something that you think should be allowed, or do you think that that opens up Pandora's box?
No, I think that opens up Pandora's box. And then you would be benefiting off of something other than your play. It would be because you did a commercial for them or because you did okay. a signing for them. Again, if you just because we have to start somewhere, right? And if we just limit it to school sold or university sold equipment, attire, whatever, and then you could even do at the end of the year, you sign a bunch of stuff and the school sells it, you get a piece of that because that happens already. I can tell you from experience. I mean, I didn't sell anything because I only played in 8 games.
Yeah.
So nobody was really clamoring over my signed anything.
Right.
But it happens, and you know them saying that we're not going to allow it. Like, well, what are you going to do if it's just me and some random guy? They don't really have control over it right now. So I think they're scared that if they open up a little crack, that it's going to open up the floodgates.
Yeah, I mean, it could. And that's why it's so tricky. I think that's why we haven't seen it, you know, get any closer to, you know, anything really happening in that regard. It's tough. It's tough for sure. But like you said, it's not going to stop what's already happening. And I think that's what scares the NCAA a lot. I know there's a plenty we want to get to. So let's kind of pivot here for a second. You played at Alabama as well. That's where you started your career before moving on to Oregon State and then Florida. You played for Saban. You mentioned that earlier. I want a Saban story, and I don't need a serious story. I don't need a sad story. I want a funny story. I want what is something that Nick Saban did? Maybe we haven't heard it before. At least my listeners haven't. That is maybe Saban in a way that we haven't seen.
Okay, so this one is it's funny now. It was not funny when it happened.
Okay.
It's one of those where you know people are telling you to laugh at yourself in the moment, but that's the last thing you want to do. So I've told this story only a handful of times, and I was a true freshman. The starting quarterback was redshirt senior AJ McCarron, and I was him getting hurt away from playing. A lot of people don't know that Blake Sims was the backup, but with Blake, they were going to run more wildcat stuff. And if we needed to run our traditional offense, I was going to go in. So I got the yips like midway through the season and I could not hit anything. I had no confidence. I hated being there. They didn't enjoy winning because they do it so much. And I'm sure players struggle with it now. It's like when you win every game, you did your job. But when you lose, it's like the sky is falling. So we're playing well. We're winning. I'm not having a great time and I'm not playing well in practice. And at the end of every, I think it's Wednesday and Thursday practices. No, sorry, it's Monday practices. They run wide receivers and tight ends run against linebackers and defensive backs, and they run either a go or a post. And the quarterbacks basically just, you know, throw balls. It's conditioning. It's after the last period of practice. It's basically conditioning while competing. It's nice as quarterbacks because you're just kind of sitting there throwing the ball,
yeah.
And you have to do like one sprint at the end, right? So Saban is standing in the middle of the field about 40 yards away. and I keep missing post routes over the outside shoulder.
Okay.
So when you throw a post route, you can miss inside because the wide receiver can just readjust inside and he's already running that way, right?
Right.
If you throw it over the outside, that's really difficult to adjust to. So I miss one inside, and Coach Saban says something like, oh, you're doing this today. You're going to miss – or sorry, I miss outside. You're doing this today. You're going to miss outside when we keep telling you. You know, he starts doing this, Nick Saban, you know, miss to the inside. And I'm like, okay, I might lose it. AJ goes, perfect ball. Blake goes, good ball. I go. I'm like, please give me a go. And Coach Nussmeier, who's my offensive coordinator yep. at Florida, is keeping my feet to the fire. He gives me post. All right, here we go. Drop back, throw it, miss to the outside on the other side of the field. And Saban doesn't say anything. He just kind of turns and looks at me. And I'm thinking, oh, God, that's like the worst thing that he could ever say is nothing. Because when you stop getting coached, that's when they give up on you.
Yep.
So I'm like, okay, I have to hit this next one. I am not missing outside. So we have to flip sides before I can go again. So I have to run by Coach Saban. And he says something like, I can complete that behind my back. And I said something like, I bet you can. Or like, I was pissed off.
To Saban?
Smartass. Yeah, I said it, and I'm sure he heard like half of it. There's no way he heard all of it.
Oh, God.
So I get back up. AJ goes, good ball. Blake goes, good ball. I get back up. Coach Nuss gives me a post. I'm like, all right. Joke's on him. I'm not missing outside. I don't even care if it's complete. I'm just not missing outside. So Saban's 40 yards away again, middle of the field, and drop back. And I think it might have been Amari Cooper, actually. And I throw it so far to the inside and so far past Amari Cooper that he like stopped running and the DB stopped running. I hit Coach Saban.
Yes.
Right in the man area.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he didn't flinch. He didn't move at all.
Oh.
Okay. Either he's the Terminator or he's missing something down there. And all he did was two fingers in the air and kind of flick them up and down like a light switch, which means blow the horn. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. And AJ, everybody's laughing. Everybody that is there. Other position groups are doing, you know, their own drills. Everybody that's at that one is, oh, my God. Oh, and AJ is like relentless in my ear. Oh, my God, I've been here for 5 years. I've never done that. So bring it up. You have to run to bring it up as a team. And I'm running in and he's just staring a hole through me. I mean, like, you know, that look that like you get from your dad when you're young and like
right.
he's pissed. It's like that look. It's like I'm about to get spanked. And looks at me. I finally get to him. I take a knee and he goes, you know, I don't think I've ever had somebody miss that bad that many times in that drill. And I said, swear to God, I said this. Well, at least you'll remember me. And he said, yeah, not quite how I wanted to remember you. And everybody is like, what'd he do? And Saban doesn't stop it from happening. He like, lets people tell them what happened, which was like never a thing. So I was humiliated, but now it's funny because I hit Saban right in the groin area.
Wow. Wow. You cup checked Nick Saban.
I did. Yeah, I did from 40 yards away. How about that accuracy?
That is 99 accuracy on Madden. That is outstanding. Yeah. Man. Wow. I am very glad you told me that story. That is
it's a good one.
And that's not what you didn't transfer after that. He didn't force you to leave.
Okay. I thought he might. The next day at practice, I'm pretty sure somebody showed it to me on film. I don't know why they were filming that, but yeah.
You realize you're sitting on a gold mine right now. If you could get that film, that has to still exist. Saban probably keeps the tape of recruits from 25 years ago. He has to have tape of that practice. You need to go hit up the GA, go get that film, and you could sell that for a ransom beyond anything. You could retire tomorrow if you had video of you hitting Nick Saban in the balls.
Yep. I know. But to be honest, I don't know if I want it out there like that. Telling it is cringeworthy enough.
That's
true. I don't want people having that on me for years to come.
That's true. Well, you survived it. You did fine. You're still here. You're still breathing somehow.
I tell you what, it didn't feel like it when it happened. I thought my heart stopped.
That's amazing.
But it's funny now. It's funny now. It wasn't funny then.
Exactly. That's amazing. All right. Well, on that note, let's talk some football, man, for just a few minutes before you go. We'll stick with Alabama, man. So I'm starting to ask this question. I bet on Alabama before the season to win the national title. I took them at plus 220. They're already down below a dollar favorite. It's them or the field at this point. And I love Georgia, and I love Clemson, and even I like Ohio State. I just don't think any of them are going to be on the level of Alabama, and mostly because of what Tua has brought to that offense. But if I had to tell you right now, you can take Alabama or the field to win the national title, who would you take?
You know, it's crazy that this is even a question, but I would probably take Alabama.
Yeah.
And because we've never seen them have an offense like this.
Right.
You know, Nick Saban is in charge of that defense. They're going to be good. If they're not good right now, they will be in 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks or when they play LSU and Auburn and the games that really matter. They had 7 points scored against them, and it was on the first play, so there's a lot of nerves, and maybe you overextend and you're a little tight and stiff. By a good offense, a good Ole Miss offense. They only scored 7. And then they said, okay, that's enough. If you think you're going to throw it all over us, you're not. And the offense that they have is it the best in the country? I can't think of anybody else who I'm more afraid of than Tua leading that offense, which has always been a juggernaut, but it's always been running the ball. And, like, I see him play, and I'm like, okay, that was complete. Okay, yeah, that was a good ball. Okay, that was a good ball. And then he's out of the game because it's 35-0. I'm like, what just happened? You know, like when you watch LeBron or KD score 35, it doesn't feel like 35. I think Colin Cowherd said that. That's so true. And when I watch Alabama's offense, it doesn't feel like they're killing the other team. And then you look at the score and it's like, whoa, this game is over. And it's middle of the second quarter. And the other team just wants the game to be over with now. You know, so I got Bama for sure.
Well, and the reason they do it that way is they're not Oklahoma State. They're not, you know, Oregon, the old Oregon that we knew. I mean, it's not flashy. It's just, you know, we'll pop 6, 7, 8 yards of play. We'll probably eventually wear you down and get that 40-yard touchdown. That's what it seems like they do. It's like they just chunk, and then eventually you just wear down before the drive even ends. It's very rare that they're just wide open, gunning it all over the field. It's just very methodical, and nobody can stop it. I mean, period. Nobody can stop it. Najee Harris is the backup running back, and he's one of the best running backs in the country. Of course, Damien Harris is a stud. I mean, Tua has changed that offense completely. Tua hasn't attempted a pass in the fourth quarter of a game yet this season. Neither is Jake Fromm, to be fair to Georgia. But it's wild to think that they're just this dominant. It was amazing to me. Did you think, honestly, that Ole Miss was going to keep that within? The line was 22, I think it got out to like 23.5 at one point. But within 3 to 4 touchdowns, did you think Ole Miss could do that?
I tell you what, I know the over-under was 71 because I lost by 2 points, and I'm pretty pissed
about
that still.
Me too. God, that was ridiculous.
When they scored on the first play, I'm thinking, awesome.
Yep.
All I need you to do is score 17-21, and then Alabama will make 100%. A statement, win by 40, boom, easy money. First play of the game, oh, I won. Sweet. And then I turn on the game probably middle of the third quarter, and they've got Mac Jones in, the third-string quarterback, and he's just handing the ball off every play. I'm like, oh, no.
You saw it coming.
They're just going to milk it all the way, and they kick the field goal, and I'm like, okay, I only need one more field goal, and of course they didn't do it. But, you know, I thought Ole Miss would hang with them for, I mean, a couple more minutes. It was like, if you don't score, you know, drive for drive with them, it's over. Because their offense is too good. It used to be, how do we score any points on this team? Now it's, how do we score enough points to even keep up with them? So I don't see them being beat anytime soon.
Well, I mean, Saban has finally caught up to the times where the teams that beat them in the past, it was Johnny Manziel, it was the Ole Miss, you know, wide open offense from a few years back. It was Auburn. It was teams that had multiple weapons, dynamic quarterback play, and you could just try to outscore Alabama. I mean, even remember Alabama didn't lose this game, but they played Auburn a couple years ago. The final score was like 59-45 or something outrageous like that. And it was just, I think that was the point in time. I want to say that was Blake Sims' year when he was a starter. But yep. It just kind of seems like Alabama has slowly caught up. And now that Tua is firmly entrenched as the guy, I mean, there's no hole. There's nowhere to go to attack them. They're not exposed anywhere. The armor is complete. It's a full body armor now, and there's nowhere to attack them. I think they're going to win it all. I love Georgia. I think Georgia, in most years, Georgia would win the national championship almost in any other season, it seems like. But I just don't know that they're going to. I don't know that they're going to be able to compete as dynamic as they're on offense with what Alabama has. And that's it sucks for Georgia. It sucks for Clemson too, because Clemson's got a hell of a team, but they don't have what Alabama has, and that's it's tough to say. So
Clemson needs to go ahead and name Trevor Lawrence.
Yes,
starter.
They do.
I mean, Kelly Bryant, I feel really bad for the guy because he led him to the playoff last year and he's played really well, but you can tell he's playing looking over his shoulder.
Yep.
I mean, it's obvious. So just rip the Band-Aid off, start the freshman, get him some experience, let the team settle in. You can tell they're not really settled in because you constantly keep going back and forth. And Alabama's playing Jalen Hurts too when the game is already won.
Yes.
The only time that he went in where the game was still kind of close was Louisville. So it helps the team so much when you stick with the guy. I thought Florida was going to bench their guy, but good for them, good for Dan Mullen. They stuck with Felipe even through his struggles, and I think the team is better for it. But going back to the way that Alabama has lost is always with a mobile guy. It's also a freak play
yes.
in two or three.
Yes.
I mean, think about the time that they lost. The only one that I can think of where they got beat in the regular season was Cam Newton, Auburn. They got beat. They got outplayed in the second half. They had a lead and they blew it. There wasn't a bunch of freak plays. Auburn just executed. The kick six game that I was at, they had two touchdowns with linemen down the field 5 yards.
Yeah.
It was criminal.
Yeah.
Johnny Manziel, he had that, you know, the play that we all know.
Yep.
And then Ole Miss, back-to-back years, had insane plays
yep.
that just went their way. I mean,
right.
I think it was Chad Kelly just threw a ball up and it ended up being tip, caught touchdown.
Yep.
So you need those plays to beat them as well. If you're going to flat out outplay them, you need a special player like Deshaun Watson.
Exactly. That's the difference. Is it's either a fluke play or outstanding quarterback play. I mean, the one loss I think that was the most inexplicable, because it wasn't for a fluke play and it wasn't, they didn't lose to a great quarterback, was when they lost to South Carolina in 2010, when Steven Garcia and Alshon Jeffrey beat them. And that was pre-Jadeveon Clowney. I mean, that was a good South Carolina team. It wasn't an amazing team. That was one of the most probably inexplicable losses they've had. They're nowhere near that right now. Alabama's not going. They just don't get upset. Clemson has been upset each of the last 2 years. They've lost games as 21-point favorites. Alabama's not going to do that, certainly not this year. And Tua's obviously a big reason why. Tua is right now the Heisman favorite in Vegas. Some people are starting to put Kyler Murray ahead of him in their ranking. ESPN did it on Tuesday. I said before the season, Luke, I predicted that Kyler Murray would win the Heisman. I thought that because he's playing in Lincoln Riley's offense, he's going to put up absurd numbers. He's going to be playing for a team that's actually probably going to be in some close games where he's going to be playing in important moments, whereas Tua Tagovailoa is not going to be playing in the fourth quarter of most of his games. I thought that was going to be a big advantage for him. I thought with the Heisman Trophy being as much about the storylines and it's not necessarily a popularity contest, but there's an element of that about how much do you captivate the nation, the baseball storyline, the replacing Baker Mayfield storyline. I thought that he would just be a more interesting, a more popular player than Tua, who's just part of a machine. And it seems like that's kind of coming to bear here. 3 weeks in, Kyler's been outstanding, and he's starting to get that buzz as one of those guys who could be a favorite. Oklahoma has to win a lot of games down the stretch. They're probably going to have to at least win 11, if not go undefeated, for him to get it. if you were a betting man right now and I gave you Tua or Kyler Murray, who's going to finish higher in the Heisman or who would win the Heisman, which one would you take?
I would put every single dollar that you gave me on Tua.
Okay.
Because I don't think, like you said, Oklahoma's going to have to win 11 games or go undefeated, and they're just not going to do that. That defense is not good enough to support that team. And you just got into a shootout with Iowa State. Like, and you let UCLA score on you. Like, I don't see it. So, yes, Alabama is beating teams so badly that we're not really getting to see a lot of Tua. But, you know, when they play Mississippi State, Auburn, LSU, those games will be close. You know, Georgia, I'm not sure if Heisman voters include championship games. They should, because if your team is good enough and you led your team to that point,
yeah, it
you
does.
Should include the games that you played. Good.
Yeah.
So I think it'll end up being Tua. I just think they're asking so much of Kyler Murray that he's going to end up pressing a little bit.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, though. He is my favorite player to watch right now because he's right. So unique. I mean, look, he's tiny. He's like 5'9", right? And he plays football like he's playing baseball. He's, you know, turning two to throw a slant.
Yeah.
He's scrambling out, making the same guy break his ankles twice in the same play. He's a blast to watch, and the team is fun to watch because it's always a close game because their defense isn't good. They're kind of like the Chiefs right now. You know, they score a ton of points,
yeah,
but they also give up a ton of points. It's like, okay, well, that's fun to watch, but a lot of the Heisman has turned into, well, is the team good? It's like, well, doesn't this go to the best player, not the best team? But in order to be in those nationally televised games, the big hyped-up games, you have to be a one-loss or an undefeated team.
Yeah, and if you think about the guys in the last 8 or 9 years that won the Heisman who weren't on a national championship contender, it was Lamar and it was RG3. I mean, you want to go back to Tebow, would have been the last one. They went 9-3 the year he won it in 07. Those three guys, especially Lamar and RG3, they had moments in big games that were their signature moment. Now, it was for Lamar, it was shredding Florida State, and he pretty much wrapped up the Heisman in week 3, which almost never happens. And then for RG3, it was the comeback win against Oklahoma in the fourth quarter. And I think that's why I would push back on Tua a little bit. Now, to his credit or to his benefit, LSU looks a hell of a lot better than we thought they'd be. Mississippi State's going to be good. And then, of course, he gets Georgia in the championship game. So he is going to be in some big moments. I think Alabama has to be in a game where they're tested. Because where Lamar shredded Florida State and dominated them, that was surprising to us. We didn't expect it. And a lot of times the Heisman is about, well, can you defy our expectations? If Tua throws for 5 touchdowns against Auburn, I mean, he's going to get a ton of credit, but are we really going to be surprised that Alabama went out and won a game by 30 points? I mean, that's so much par for the course now that I wonder if that's almost going to work against him at the end of the day. I'm not saying he's not going to win the Heisman, because he certainly could. I just think that Kyler Murray with that offense, I think it almost works in his favor that the defense isn't dominant, because he's going to have to win them games. And if he does, then I think he's going to get a leg up on Tua. But it's going to be a close race. I mean, those two guys are super fun to watch. And I think that at the end of the day, it's probably going to come down to either one of them for the Heisman.
Yeah, you know, again, I disagree with you on that point, but I understand where you're coming from. I think if Tua continues what he's doing, which is 100% on third down,
yeah,
he's out by the second or third, maybe right, the third quarter. If he does that against those teams and they don't give him the Heisman, it'll be more criminal than when Christian McCaffrey didn't win it or Derrick Henry.
Okay, I mean, what if you switched
that
him?
Game, if I switch,
what if you Tua switched to Kyler and Tua? Would you say the same thing about Kyler Murray at Alabama? Because they'd be the same team.
If Kyler had the stats that Tua has, and Tua has the stats that Kyler had, yes, I would say Kyler deserves to win because he's been perfect, and you can't you can't discredit them because they're killing teams by so much. It's like, look, I'm doing my job perfectly,
right,
and just because half the team isn't doing their job as well as the other half,
yeah,
they shouldn't win. You know, it's like, it's not our fault that we're way better than everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. And I agree with your logic. I wonder if that's the way the voters are going to think. Because, like I said, so many times the Heisman has become, yes, it is about being a part of a great team. But I think it's as much about defying expectations or coming out of nowhere. If you think about it, I made this point on this podcast plenty of times, Luke, but think about the Heisman winners from the last 10 years. You really only had Marcus Mariota, Derrick Henry, and then last year it would have been Baker Mayfield. Those are the only three guys in the last 10 years who were preseason favorites. They were guys that were among the top two or three candidates before the season. Every other guy that's won it kind of came out of nowhere. Lamar came out of nowhere. Jameis Winston was a freshman. Manziel was a freshman. You go back to RG3 came out of nowhere. So a lot of those guys, it's almost like there were other terrific players, other guys that had great seasons that maybe deserved as much or might have deserved to win it. But when you outperform your expectations, I think that goes a long way. And I think Tua, the ceiling was so damn high for that guy. I mean, he came into the season as the favorite. He played two quarters of football.
Okay, so I think, yes, you know, Jameis was a freshman. Johnny was a freshman. Lamar came out of nowhere. Even if you look at Carson Palmer, A Football Life on Carson Palmer on NFL Network came out. And I didn't realize this, but he was, like, terrible at USC until his senior year, where he tore it up. So he came out of nowhere, too. I don't think the Heisman voters should say, okay, well, Tua was the favorite. So, you know, are we sure that this is the guy? I think the best guy in college football for 95% of the time has won the Heisman Trophy. I think sometimes they get a little enamored with, he's a West Coast guy. You know, Christian McCaffrey's year 2 or 3 years ago was undoubtedly the best player in the country that year. And Derek won it because he's 6'3", 245 pounds, and plays for Alabama, and they were undefeated.
Right.
That is why he won. So that's the only one that I can think of where I said, that makes no sense. And Christian lost because he plays at 11 p.m. East Coast time. But every other one, I've said, yeah, he's the best player in the country. When Jameis was a freshman, I said, he is the best quarterback in the country right now. His freshman year was his best year that I've seen him play, NFL included. He was efficient. He let the offense work for him. He didn't force throws. I mean, how many picks did he throw? Like 3 or 4?
And it was something outrageous.
That's like an average game now for him. You know,
right.
He just got into this, I have to be a hero, instead of letting the game come to him, which I think both Kyler and Tua are doing right now. I just think Tua's team is better, yes, but he's just executed more crisply.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch. I mean, no doubt about it. It's going to be a fun debate. It's far from over. And those guys are both going to have big games down the stretch where they're going to get to kind of trade blows, and that's going to be fun to watch. So, Luke, man, I feel like we could go on forever. I know you're like me. Sometimes you hate to wrap it up, but we got to do that. I tell you what, man, we should do this again sometime for sure, because that was, without a doubt, one of the best interviews we've had on the show. You did a great job, man, and I'd love to have you on again.
I appreciate it. Thank you again for having me. And if you guys can, please go check out my show, The Dropback. It's on Monday, Wednesday, Friday nights, 6 to 6:40 p.m. East Coast time. Also on Sunday at noon East Coast time. I am on Twitter. I stream live on Twitter and YouTube. I'm also on iTunes podcast and SoundCloud. Please listen. I think you guys will love the content. It's a lot of what you just listened to with me and Josh, and I love doing this. I would love to do it again.
Yeah, perfect, man. Well, that's awesome. I'm sure you'll have more people checking it out, because that was great. So if you have any more Nick Saban stories, just get them ready for the next time.
Okay, that sounds great.
And now welcome on Dane Brugler from The Athletic. He is an NFL draft analyst for them, does a terrific job, a guy who I've really come across more recently, only for the last couple months, Dane. I'll be honest, no offense, didn't really read your stuff before you joined The Athletic, but I've been a subscriber there for a year, and once you stopped, once you came onto The Athletic scene, I really enjoyed it. I've read everything you've put out there, and it's awesome stuff. And the first thing that you actually wrote when you joined The Athletic was your story of how you kind of became involved with scouting, writing about the NFL draft and whatnot. So for those of us who are the listeners who haven't heard that story, kind of give us the synopsis of how you got involved and from where you started to how you got to where you are now.
Well, I appreciate it, Josh. Scouting is something that I fell in love with at a very young age. Really growing up in Northeast Ohio, when the Browns came back in 1999, that draft, I fell in love with the process. Why this college quarterback would make a good pro, or, you know, this player and that player, and that the whole transition from college player to the pro, I fell in love with. And so, my my dad's not an NFL coach. I don't have those ties to a team, you know. So I always use the example, if you want to be a doctor, you go to medical school. If you want to be a lawyer, you go to law school. If you want to be a scout or, you know, be an evaluator in the NFL, you kind of have to make your own path. And so for me, what I just chose to do was put myself in as many positions possible to learn and network and just see where it took me. And I went to Mount Union, Division III powerhouse. I was a senior the same year as Pierre Garçon. And so we had scouts coming through all the time. And I worked with the football team where I was helping set up the scouts and, you know, at practice and in the press box, all that. So I was able to network with them. A lot of them took me under their wing. That helped. And then just paying my way to scouting events, Senior Bowl, all that. That was kind of my scouting education. A lot of great stories that way. And so I caught on with the media, doing stuff with CBS Sports and NFL Draft Scout, a lot of other places along the way. It's something that I've turned down some NFL jobs. And then there have been other times when I've interviewed for a job and didn't get it and was really disappointed. So, you know, as long as I'm scouting, I'm happy. And so I recently went over to The Athletic about a month ago now, and it's been a great month. It's been a lot of fun. I love the people I'm with, and they allow me to cover the NFL draft 365 days a year. And really, that's as long as I'm covering the draft and scouting, I'm happy. So I'm glad a lot of people are enjoying the content so far.
Yeah, it's cool to see that, because I have a lot of people who listen to this who are still in college or just out of college. And look, we're all in that same boat, right? I mean, when you get to that point when you're out of school or you say you want to work in sports, a lot of people say that, but it's not often that you find the people who are truly willing to hustle and grind and do the things that you did to get where you got. And it's pretty cool to see. And it's neat to also know that, you know, you've had opportunities to get involved with the league itself. And somebody, do you know Kevin Weidel at all?
Yeah, no, I know him very well.
Yeah, so Kevin's a good buddy of mine. We worked together at ESPN for years and did plenty of stuff together. And talking to Kevin's a guy who was doing the media thing for a while and worked with McShay, obviously with Scouts Inc., and did such an awesome job, and then ends up, you know, joining the Baltimore Ravens. It's just a really cool transition to see that. So I'm sure at some point, if that's something that you wanted to be a part of, I'm sure you would. And, you know, for the time being, the NFL draft has become a 365-day-a-year conversation. I mean, it's
right.
Always, you know, we're looking at these college games, but looking at them through the scope of the draft is always fascinating. And while it's early in the season, I think there's plenty to talk about related to the draft. And I'm curious to get your thoughts as a guy who looks at this through maybe a different lens than most of us who are covering college football day to day. You might have a different perspective on some things. So I wanted to get started and talk about Alabama and Georgia. And they're, I think right now, clearly the two best teams in the country. I think Clemson and Ohio State are probably a half step below them. You can correct me if you think I'm wrong. But in your mind, in terms of NFL talent, I would frame it between Alabama and Georgia. If there's somebody else you want to throw in there, go ahead. Who do you think has the most NFL talent? How would you compare those two teams?
Yeah, and I'm with you. I think they're the two most talented teams that we have in college football right now. I think Clemson and Ohio State, they come close. If they're not on the same level, you know, they're just right underneath. And just in terms of talking raw talent on the roster, but Alabama and Georgia, they're absolutely loaded on both sides of the ball. Alabama, they've been the gold standard, and I think until Georgia knocks them off in terms of winning a national title, in terms of producing more NFL talent, it's always going to be Alabama. And so last year, for example, they had 12 players drafted. I think Georgia had six, half that many. One of these years, Georgia is going to have more. But for the time being, again, Alabama is still the gold standard. And even though they put a dozen guys in the NFL draft this year, they just reload and they bring in a new class, and they already have a handful of future first rounders just on defense. You look at Raekwon Davis up front. He's a beast. Quinnen Williams, Deontay Thompson, the safety. He's emerged as one of the best ball hawks in the country, playing that center field position where he can roam, play both sidelines. The ball skills, the closing burst, he'll come up and hit you. He had a forced fumble against Ole Miss over the weekend. He's turned himself into one of the premier safeties. This isn't a great safety class coming up, but Deontay Thompson's one of the few that could be a first-round pick. You know, they're just a linebacker, Mack Wilson, Anthony Jennings. So, you know, once again, Alabama's loaded on the defensive side. The corners, they're raw, but they got a lot of ability on offense. They're the top senior running back with Damian Harris. You have a left tackle with first round potential. It might be at guard. Some teams are looking at him. Jonah Williams more as an inside player. And then you have a bunch of guys that aren't even draft eligible yet, but yet they're game changers.
Right.
It starts with Tua at the quarterback position. I think he has to be the favorite for the Heisman at this point. Some of the wide receivers, Judy. Alabama is just absolutely loaded. I think they have to be the favorite to win it all again this year and, you know, just continue to be that producer of NFL talent. But with Georgia, they lost a lot as well. You look at just on offense with, you know, both running backs, their top receiver, some studs on the offensive line. But you love the skill position they brought back with Swift at running back. Their wide receivers might be the best in the nation just as a collective unit.
Yeah.
You got Riley Ridley, Calvin's little brother. Hardman is a special athlete. Demetrius Robinson comes over from Cal, transfer, Georgia native. So, and then on defense, DeAndre Baker, probably the top senior cornerback in this class. Tyler Clark, one of the best SEC defensive linemen. So Alabama's still the gold standard, but Georgia, they're loaded with talent as well. It's going to be fun. It's hard to see the SEC title game not being those two teams, and there's a good chance they're both undefeated.
Right. With Alabama, in their secondary, you started talking about some of the guys in that secondary who are, you know, clearly emerging as top-flight guys. It's a young and experienced group, but I thought before the season, Dane, when people pointed to that secondary as maybe the weak link on this team, for whatever that's worth, I just said to myself, when are we going to stop questioning Alabama just because we don't know the names? I mean, I know that they're replacing a lot of guys, but when was the last time Alabama replaced a unit and they skipped a beat? I mean, it just doesn't seem to happen. I mean, do you think that secondary is truly could be a downfall at some point? I know they're probably going to run the table. We understand how dominant they are. Ole Miss, we thought, was going to test that secondary. They scored 7 points in the first minute and then didn't score again. And they have one of the best passing attacks in the country. So, I mean, is this secondary truly by Alabama standards, is it truly a vulnerability, or do you think that those guys are maybe a little better than the national media has given them credit for?
Well, I don't think they're vulnerable, if only for the fact that the front seven puts so much pressure on the quarterback that, you know, you can have inexperience in the secondary and it's not going to matter because the quarterback has a second and a half to throw the ball. And so, you know, with so many things happening on the field, it's just, you know, we saw it in the Ole Miss game. The quarterback, he's got to process so much going on that, you know, because there's so much happening with Alabama's speed on that side of the ball, that he's going to make mistakes. And yeah, I mean, you look at that secondary, Deontay Thompson, he had 2 starts coming into the year and he was the most experienced guy. And so I think that's where the doubts came in, is because it's not like Alabama was losing one big guy in the secondary, 2 or 3, literally the top 4 guys, all starters, were gone. And so Deontay Thompson with 2 starts, the most experienced guy, but it's, you know, they didn't miss a beat. Their corners, Trevon Diggs, you see the length that he has is tremendous. Savion Smith, you know, both these guys are inexperienced, and it shows at times. They're not lockdown guys, not yet at least, but they at least have that potential, and the front seven makes all the difference.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like you said, it can help when the quarterback's got to get rid of the ball before it even hits 2 on the mental clock. So that makes a big difference. As far as Georgia goes, they lose Nick Chubb, they lose Sonny Michel, 2 guys who went in this second round of the draft. I tend to think that this group of running backs they have now could possibly be better than those 2 guys. I mean, Elijah Holyfield and DeAndre Swift, I mean, it doesn't hurt to replace 2 NFL guys with those 2. I mean, what do you make of them? I mean, in terms of how they, I guess, stack up against what Georgia's rushing attack was a year ago.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that they could be better than the last 2 Georgia running backs. And, you know, we saw both of them go, in the top 35? I mean, so fairly high in the draft. But, yeah, Swift, he might be the most special athlete of the four with what he could do with the ball in his hands. Holyfield, I mean, he's making his dad proud with just that low physical style of play, his dad being, of course, boxer Evander Holyfield. Just a physical guy. It kind of fits the Nick Chubb, where DeAndre Swift's the Sony Michel in terms of the thunder and lightning and all that. So No, I think you're absolutely right. And with Fromm being a sophomore and a year older, yeah, that offense, they started a little bit slow against South Carolina. They eventually pulled away. Eager to see them this weekend against Missouri, who they're going to put up a lot of points. Right. They're not going to be able to stop Georgia, but it's going to be a case where they're probably going to have to outscore them. So the scoreboard's going to get lit up this weekend. So that should be a fun one.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny story. I met Elijah Holyfield when he was, I guess, a junior in high school, the summer before his senior year. And we interviewed him, and I asked him then. I mean, he was a tank. I mean, 16 years old, and he looked like he should already be in the NFL. And I'm like, I got to ask you, Elijah, when was the first time you benched 225 pounds? He was like, seventh grade? I was like, okay. I said, well, that tells me everything I need to know. I mean, the guy's biceps were as big as my head. So, I mean, yeah, they have such a ridiculous tandem there. And time will tell if they stack up against Chubb and Michelle. I think they could have the chance to be just as good, if not better, in terms of, again, just replacing the production that they got from those guys. So, all right, moving on from Alabama, Georgia, let's talk about the quarterbacks. I'm curious if you think this is a down year for the quarterback class. I certainly don't see an Andrew Luck. We don't see a Jameis Winston. Do we see a Carson Wentz, a Jared Goff? I mean, who is the best quarterback in this class, and how does it stack up to some of the classes we've seen in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, the quarterback class, I think it's really fluid at this point because there's a lot of talent at the college level in terms of quarterbacks. It's just trying to figure out, okay, are they ready for the NFL, and okay, where are they in their development? So that, you know, where do you draft the player? It's September, so it's still, you know, very early in the process. A lot of the quarterbacks in contention, like I said, they're underclassmen, so there's a lot we still don't know about what they can do. But I will say this, when I studied all the quarterbacks, the draft eligible guys over the summer, Oregon's Justin Herbert was the most talented guy that I looked at. I think he has the highest ceiling of all these quarterbacks, 6'5", 240 pounds, great athlete, strong arm, really nice touch downfield, really high football intelligence. I think the toughest job of an evaluator is trying to figure out a player's ceiling. Where are they on their timeline? Are they just the beginning? Are they near the end? And I think Herbert has the skills to be a top pick, to be a productive pro. We just need to see more growth this season and, you know, more consistency to see where he is on that timeline. I think he has the potential to be a number one overall type of player. It's just whether or not he'll reach that point where he's ready by the end of the year. And it's going to be a great test Saturday night against Stanford. Right. That should give us a good gauge of kind of where he is in his development. But there are plenty of other quarterbacks that, you know, you like and you think could be first round players. Auburn's Jarrett Stidham, a lot of tools to work with, the size, the arm strength, the mobility. One area where I really struggle with him is he has a tough time creating those second chance plays, panics a little bit under pressure, doesn't really use all his tools to his advantage. So I need to see that from Stidham before, you know, I think we need to talk about him as a surefire first round pick. Missouri's Drew Locke, he's got an NFL arm. I think teams, they like his makeup. And when I study him, I get a lot of flashbacks to Derek Carr when he was at Fresno State. Just that golden arm, some good, some bad. There's a lot of ability there. So excited for him. He could be the top senior. And then I think the dark horse in all this is Ohio State's Dwayne Haskins, who had never started a game up until this season. There's a lot of hype. Urban Meyer called him the best quarterback recruit he had ever seen. So there's plenty of hype for Haskins coming into this year, especially when he came in relief against Michigan last year and looked great. And so far through three games, he's lived up to the hype and more. And we expected it in the first two games against Rutgers, Oregon State. But what he did against TCU, he just makes it look easy out there because he has the arm talent that is just, it's special. It's not only the velocity, but it's the accuracy. It's his anticipation. For a guy with three career starts, it's really impressive. Only a redshirt sophomore, but being 3 years removed from high school, he is draft eligible. And so if you flash forward to April and you tell me that Haskins was the first quarterback drafted, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I think he has that type of talent.
I actually am with you. You talk about ceiling. I mean, for a guy to do this in only three games of real experience, I guess if you want to count Michigan last year, four, It stands to reason he could get a lot better. Is there a guy – we love comparisons. They're sexy. They're attractive. They're great in the media. Is there a guy that you would compare Haskins to? I'm an untrained eye, and I see a Winston, Big Ben type, you know, big body type quarterback for him. Who's a guy that maybe he reminds you of that's in the league right now?
Yeah, that's tough because I don't think there is a great comparison for him. I mean, he's you know, maybe it's just the Ohio State jersey fooling me, but, you know, he looks like a – if Cardale Jones was an accurate quarterback, you know, maybe that's what it would look like. But, no, I like the Big Ben. That makes some sense because just, you know, that big – you know, not a bad athlete by any means,
he can move.
But a little clunky in the pocket. But yeah, I mean, you're not a statue either. So yeah, that's not a bad one. Comparisons are tough because, you know, it's rarely apples to apples, and I'm not sure we have a great one for Haskins yet.
Yeah. So you talked about a couple guys who are in those RPO schemes, that spread offense, and you're starting to see that permeate more into the NFL. That's been a big storyline through the first couple weeks. The Bears are doing it with Trubisky. The Chiefs are doing it with Mahomes. How has that changed evaluating quarterback play now that NFL teams are starting to adopt more of that college-like offensive scheme? Not totally, but you're at least seeing more of it. Is it making it harder, easier to evaluate quarterbacks? I mean, I feel like there's so much now, much more involved than just what he does and his production in college, but how he translates to the NFL.
Sure, and it's something that, yeah, we're going to talk about every year with these quarterbacks. You know, Baker Mayfield last year, coming from that offense with Lincoln Riley, how would that translate? And, you know, it's a fair question because, you know, we know from you know, from past experience, just, you know, football history has taught us that a lot of this is a trickle-up effect. You know, it starts at high school, and then college starts to implement some of these, you know, different, you know, whether it's formation, whether it's play calls, schemes, whatever. The college starts to do it, and then it trickles up to the NFL. But, you know, the job of these college these coaches, it's not to prep quarterbacks for necessarily what they're going to see at the NFL, but their job is to win football games, plain and simple. So for a lot of these quarterbacks at the college level, the best way to win is to make their job easier. You know, you predetermine the reads. You make you have simple 1-2 progressions, high to low reads, that type of thing. So a lot of these quarterbacks, they don't know what they're getting themselves into in the NFL. I mean, Pat Mahomes is a great example of a guy who went from a Texas Tech offense that was completely different than what he's doing now, but he went to a perfect spot because Andy Reid has a great understanding of the strengths of a quarterback and then kind of implementing that into the play call. But even Pat Mahomes, he wasn't ready to go from day one. He sat out all of last year. So, you know, the job of a scout in these types of situations, figure out, okay, how much does a quarterback know? What's their retention and execution habits? Can he digest, implement different concepts? You know, just the whole mentality of the position. And it can be the toughest part. Some of that stuff you can see on tape, but, you know, we know the mental part is so important, if not more important than the physical part. And so, you know, that's why the whiteboard is so important. We see at the combine and the pre-draft process. You need a quarterback with, it doesn't matter what the scheme is or what, you know, you need a quarterback with quick recall. It doesn't matter the situation, the volume. And so I think with that said, we're seeing a lot of the spread concepts bleed into the NFL game just to make it easier on these quarterbacks. And not only that, but it does help stress the defense, something we see at the college level and something that we've seen at the NFL level. Now it can be tougher because the athletes at the NFL level are just so far superior than what we have at the college level. But, I mean, even teams, they're, what, 60, 70% of the time shotgun for a lot of teams. Right. You know, it's changed so much over the years. And I think it's helped not only gain a competitive advantage when you're facing defenses, but also help kind of bridge that gap for some of these quarterbacks.
Well, and RPOs in the NFL are a little bit safer now because, I mean, let's face it, the NFL is doing everything it can to protect these quarterbacks at all costs. Mm-hmm. So you're not maybe putting a quarterback quite in as much harm's way by running some of that stuff as you were 5-10 years ago when they weren't protecting them like they are now. I think maybe that plays a role. Pat Fitzgerald, the Northwestern coach, just a few weeks ago, or last week, made his comment about how he thinks the RPOs are communism, which I don't really know where the analogy came from, but he clearly made it obvious he's not a fan of how much teams are relying on RPOs. He's a former linebacker, defensive background. I get it. It's clearly puts a lot of stress and strain on the defense. They're very hard to defend. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about RPOs at any level, college, NFL, in terms of the way they kind of exploit the rule about getting linemen downfield, keeping them within 3 yards of the line of scrimmage? Do you think that it's good for football? Do you think they need to address this? I mean, it's clearly becoming more and more popular. It's not going away anytime soon.
No, I mean, it's not bad for the game by any means. And, you know, if they want to crack down a little bit on the linemen blocking downfield, then that's fine. I mean, the rules are in place for a reason. You know, if you want to, whether it's going to be 1 yard, 3 yards, whatever, I mean, that's fine to help, you know, help the defense a little bit. But yeah, for the most part, you know, it's I'm sure people had this conversation when, you know, when different the Wildcat, right? And going all the way back to, you know, when teams started with, you know, four wide receivers instead of, 22 personnel, you know. So it's just something that the NFL game, football in general, it's always evolving. Teams are always looking for, you know, some kind of way to get ahead. And, you know, the RPOs are just something you got to learn to defend. And, yeah, it's not going anywhere. I love Coach Fitzgerald. I'm not sure where that came from either.
Yeah. Another coach who has been just lighting the world on fire at the college level is Lincoln Riley. I mean, he is – I saw East Carolina, rather, play when he was their OC about 5 years ago, and they lit up Bud Foster. And when you light up a Bud Foster defense, you must be doing something right. And now, clearly, 5 years later, he might be the hottest name in all of college football. I know that we've seen stories and read reports that NFL teams were flocking to Norman this summer to try to learn what exactly is Oklahoma doing that is just confusing and befuddling defenses around the country. Just what do you know in the conversations you've had? You talk to these scouts and stuff. What is the type of respect of Lincoln Riley? What is he getting among NFL coaches just for what he's been able to do offensively?
Well, the smart coaches and evaluators are the ones who look around the sport, even other sports, and say, okay, what are they doing differently that's that's working? You know, what are they doing that maybe we can steal or borrow and, you know, learn from? And the NFL, it's an adapt or die league. And so I think that's why a lot of teams are looking at Riley as kind of a popular guy, especially offensive coordinators, trading offensive philosophies, trading, okay, trends. If the defense is doing this, this is what I do. And it's, you know, it's kind of a bartering information, you know. And with a guy like Lincoln Riley, there's so much there that's just fascinating. First of all, he just turned 35 years old. This is only his second year as a head coach. You know, as much as we've talked about Lincoln Riley, it feels like he's been in the league for or been in college football as a head coach for at least 5 years now. But it's only year two as for him as a head coach. So I think what he brings is a fresh perspective of the game. He came up through that Texas Tech system, but he's putting his own spin on things. And he's having big time success with now two different quarterbacks. And that's another interesting dynamic because both are transfers. Mayfield starting at Texas Tech and then walking on to Oklahoma, Kyler Murray at A&M. That didn't work out. And so, you know, Lincoln Riley is doing a lot with two guys that two of the programs basically, you know, couldn't figure out. So he's showing how pliable that he can be with the way he develops players. So if you're a high school quarterback, why wouldn't you want to go play for Lincoln Riley and Norman? So I don't know if he's ever going to want to coach in the NFL, but the way he's going, I mean, the job's going to be his whenever he wants it. His trajectory is just really on a rocket right now. And it's just because he's so bright and he brings that fresh perspective of understanding the strengths of his team, the strengths of his quarterback, and then, you know, implementing that in the flow of the game and the play calling. And so far, so good.
I'd be shocked if it wasn't long and an NFL team threw too much money at him and he couldn't say no. I mean, it feels like, you know, you had Steve Spurrier in the 90s. You had Chip Kelly come along. Like, now Lincoln Riley. Like, he kind of feels like that next iteration of the offensive genius of this generation. And both of those guys gave it a run in the NFL. Didn't work for either one of them, but they both gave it a run. it feels like somebody's going to want to throw that kind of money at Lincoln Riley. Baker Mayfield got in a little bit of a kerfuffle, whatever you want to call it, over the weekend with Matt Miller, talking on Twitter about, you know, is Kyler Murray proving that Baker Mayfield might be not as good as advertised? I don't buy into that. I do buy into the fact that Lincoln Riley's done a terrific job with both of those players. But what does Kyler Murray's success, does it influence your opinion of Baker whatsoever? It doesn't to me. I feel like most smart people say no. But for the people out there who are crazy enough to think that because Kyler Murray is already a Heisman favorite means that that somehow takes away from what Baker Mayfield is as a player, what do you have to say about that? And what have you seen in Kyler so far this year?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely, I think, you know, absolutely nothing to do with it. I mean, first of all, Oklahoma's offense looks very different this year compared to last year. I mean, Lincoln Riley, he understands Murray and Mayfield, and they have different strengths. So the play calling this year is designed around Murray's strengths, specifically using his legs. So right. We're seeing option plays. We're seeing designed runs. And the job of a scout is to evaluate players independent of scheme, supporting cast, play calling. And that can be tough. Not everyone's capable of doing it. But Mayfield, he was an outstanding college player. He earned his spot as a top quarterback in this past draft with his decision-making and his accuracy. Murray's situation is just very different. He's very gifted, something we've seen through three games, using that athleticism as a big part of his game. Now, I mean, if you want to question, not you, but someone out there want to question Mayfield's maybe his adjustment to a more pro-style scheme, I can understand that. You know, Mayfield, he didn't throw a ton of throws outside the hashes downfield in college. It was RPO heavy. You know, that's something scouts focused on during last year's process. But the thought that a quarterback following a first-round quarterback would somehow create concern about that first-round quarterback, that's just – it's ludicrous. And I think most fans are too smart to fall for that.
I know that it's a foregone conclusion. He's going to play baseball after this year. Would Kyler Murray, if the NFL was, would the NFL ever be an option for him?
You know, we continue to buck trends with, you know, Russell Wilson being under 5'11", Baker Mayfield being the top pick and being, you know, under 6'2". And so, you know, you never say never, but Kyler Murray looks like he's about 5'9", and he doesn't have necessarily the build that you want. I mean, someone would absolutely give him a chance, and there's no question about that. Now, where do you invest a draft pick in a guy like that who would be a complete unicorn, you know, compared to what we know with the position? I mean, height can be overblown in terms of importance, but we've never seen a 5'9 quarterback have success. And so I think you'd have to completely change your offense with the way you do things. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying I'd be very surprised if he did go the NFL route. I mean, who knows? He might win the Heisman this year, lead Oklahoma to the playoffs, and have this great season. And maybe, you know, doubt about sticking with baseball, that might creep into his mind. But I don't know. I think that's the right way to go. Have this one last hurrah in football. He was great. I mean, he didn't lose a game in high school. He's right down the road from me, Allen, Texas. I mean, he was so much better than everybody else. I think this season for him is more about getting the bad taste out of his mouth from A&M, not, you know, his football career not ending that way, wanting to end it the right way at Oklahoma this year and then going on to baseball. I think that's the best for him. And, you know, I mean, if he's able to have a great season this year, then great. But I do think his future's in baseball.
Sure seems like it. All right, Dame, I'm going to let you go, man. I'm super excited that you came on. That was awesome. I don't have you're actually the first NFL draft guy that I've had on the podcast ever, so that was really cool.
I'm honored.
There you go, man. I even got you in before Kevin, so if you see Kevin, you can give him a little trash. I guess now that he works for the Ravens, it makes it a little harder for him to come on. Yeah,
exactly.
But we used to do a lot of great work together back at ESPN before he had to get all big and rich and famous. So anyway, man, no, thank you so much. DP Brugler on Twitter. Follow him. And Dane, I'd love to talk to you again, whether it's on the podcast, maybe it's on the radio show down the road. Let's not let this be the last time we talk.
No, sounds great. Thanks, Josh.
All right, Dane.